I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians. It's so strange because I definitely remember hearing it listening to broadcast TV, like when the Fox network, I think we didn't actually get Fox in Medford until, I want to say like the third season of Simpsons.
Okay.
So I basically missed.
Early 91, 92?
That sounds about right. And when they first got their transmitter up, it was shitty and there was all sorts of interference. And sometimes the Fox satellite feed from the network would just cut off in the middle of the prime time.
Ooh.
So, but there was always sometimes you'd be like, why is there all this crazy sound? There was like the same sound that you hear with the phone, like a jing, and you're like, well, I don't know what the hell was happening with their transmitter, but they got locked down eventually.
So Fox was the channel, the network that we got Star Trek The Next Generation on? Was that the one you got it on?
No, since it was syndicated, ours was the CBS channel.
Okay. Because
yeah.
I was curious about that because it was first run syndication, so I always thought of it as a show that was on Channel 13. And it didn't have an official network, so to speak, Star Trek, until UPN came around.
Right.
And it seems like we go through this wave where every so often Star Trek is a Ronin until Paramount has a network briefly.
Yes.
But it seems like now that they've got a streaming service that seems more or less permanent.
Now that they have a streaming service where, by and large, I think Star Trek properties are the majority of the reasons why people probably buy into it.
In a the terms of a mall, they would call that an anchor store.
Right. It's
like
it's the JCPenney of their streaming service.
Yeah, like you have these big corner buildings that are like two or three stories, and then you have the one-story mall that connects all of them. And Star Trek is one of those big buildings. It's probably two of those big buildings.
I was just reading before you came by, I was reading about Connor Trenier and... Oh, who's the motherfucker who played the weapons officer on Enterprise? What am I forgetting his name?
The British guy.
Yeah, the British guy. They have their own...
I know his character's name. Malcolm Reed.
Malcolm Reed. They have their own podcast. Him and Connor Trenier have one. And they've got a really... It's like... Of course, it's only for... Really only for, like, Star Trek fans. There's nothing... They only ever have, like, people associated with Star Trek in some way as guests. So that's the only reason why it exists. And they had Rick Berman on there. And I... Those two guys probably didn't have a lot of particular trouble with Rick Berman as a producer on their show because they weren't female. Just because everything that I've heard about Rick Berman is that he was a fucking tyrant and a sexist and a general asshole. So I was a little bit like, I understand why they would put Rick Berman on their show because he was really important for Star Trek for a long time. I also feel like we need to shrug past it and be like, listen, you're a fucking asshole. So that needs to be the preface to any conversation about Rick Berman, is that he was a dick.
But that's the thing, is these guys didn't have that experience personally with Rick Berman, but they've heard those stories by now.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, isn't Rick Berman the one who basically fired Gates McFadden at the end of season one?
Yep.
And they basically had to be threatened, basically, to bring her back.
And the reason why Denise Crosby left, and the reason why Jadzia Dax, why the actress who plays Jadzia
Dax. Oh, that's
right.
They lowballed her.
So that's three for three. Three women who had prominent exits on his Star Trek shows. It's a commonality. It's enemy action.
But yeah, exactly. But I mean, you do hear those stories by now. You hear those from co-workers, you hear those through the grapevine of Star Trek actors, that if you're a Star Trek actor, you are going to meet even people who were on other shows, one, because they may appear in a cameo on your show, or because
conventions, man.
Yeah, the convention circuit. There's going to be a grapevine there that it doesn't matter if you've never been on screen together, you're going to sit at a long table next to these people, and conversations are going
to
start.
Well, and let's also, like, we'd like to think about them like they're their own separate universes. As far as the production is concerned, people who worked on The Next Generation also worked on Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
There were some people who were the crew from that entire time, and some people who bridged across all four of them, or three of them, or two of them. So there was a contiguity of people who were there to witness how much of an asshole he was beyond just the people in front of the camera.
And people will talk. People will talk. And yeah, I wonder about stuff like that, because I don't think if you have somebody like that in your circle, you can't really pretend it didn't happen. I think you can not bring it up by not dealing with that person at all.
Right.
Not inviting them on your podcast, not talking about it, and just shunning them is your way of dealing with it. But you can't just treat them like one of the gang and have it just hanging there in the air, because if you're one of the people that this person abused or picked on or bullied or drove away, you don't want to, I don't know, you see someone else hanging out with him and being buddy-buddy with him, I don't know if I want to hang out with them, because it just says to me that...
It's the problem of being the boss, right? There is an asynchronous power dynamic, right, between the two of them. And so, obviously, the one thing you don't want to do is piss him off or let other people know that you would be unhappy with him, because you'd be afraid of what that would mean for your career, right?
Yeah. I mean, I get that while the show is happening.
Right.
But we live in the world now, like you said, this is a podcast hosted by actors doing retrospectives on a show that they were a part of.
Right.
And there's a lot of people doing that. I know that, like, the guys who played Merry and Pippin have a podcast together.
Oh, that's awesome.
I know that Jenna Fisher and the woman who played Angela on The Office have an Office podcast together. There's a lot of these TV shows have these sort of retrospective podcasts where two cast members or two crew members or a cast and a crew member reunite to reminisce about working on a beloved show.
There's also one that's Dana Carvey and I don't know who else from Saturday Night Live have. Dana Carvey and, anyways, two people who are, you know, who were longtime Saturday Night Live people who just interview previous cast members or previous guests.
Yeah, but we live in a post-Berman Star Trek world.
Right.
So if you're going to tell this guy to go fuck himself, there's nothing he can do to you. You're already part of the Star Trek family. You're not going to not get invited to Star Trek conventions.
That's the question. That's the open question is, how much of the convention stuff is
Berman territory?
Is controlled by, I doubt him, but it's controlled by a group of people, of businessmen, who had to court Berman and his entourage to be able to get these introductions to these actors and to make these things happen, right?
Yeah.
Part of it, obviously, they clearly have to clear with CBS Paramount, right? I mean, they probably have to pay licenses to Paramount.
But I think they do have the advantage now, not working for him, that they probably go directly through their agent, and their agent is on a short list with the guys that run these conventions.
Right.
It's kind of like an Macho Man Randy Savage did the Slim Jim commercials in the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
And what ended up happening was he worked for Vince McMahon, and Vince McMahon brokered that deal with the WWF at the time. And Slim Jim loved using Macho Man Randy Savage, because who the fuck else sounds like that? He has such a crazy, colorful persona, and they loved it. So then Macho Man leaves the WWF and goes to WCW, and Vince McMahon is still under the idea that this is a deal with him and his company. And they're like, no, we're going to keep working with Randy. And it's like, dude, sorry, you're out.
That's always a question that I wonder is, like when Hulk Hogan doesn't he go to WCW for a little bit of time also?
Yeah.
They have their names. I mean, obviously, they have the Terry Bottega as their name, but then they also have the character name that ostensibly, they don't recast these guys, right?
If someone, they have before.
Oh, have they really?
Yeah.
But I was going to say, I mean, does WWF own the name Hulk Hogan? They own the character?
So that's a thing that... The answer is both yes or no, depending on who you're talking about. Hulk Hogan was created before the WWF became a national thing.
Oh, I see.
That what the WWF under Vince McMahon is it started out as a New York territory, and he went national. So what he started doing was basically raiding the roster of all the territories of their best guys. And Hulk Hogan was one of the guys from, like, Minnesota. And I think Macho Man was from, like, Florida. Rowdy Roddy Piper was from Oregon. All of these guys are from all over that. So basically, they got all of their best guys and brought them into one company. So they raided the closets of all these different federations and took their best guys and pissed a lot of people off and burned a lot of bridges. But because these guys were already established and they already owned their own name, they got to come in as Rowdy Roddy Piper Macho Man Randy Savage and Hulk Hogan. So they owned their own name. But what started to happen is once there was all this money, it meant that you could get even bigger in WWF. And when you left, you could take the name and all the stuff attached to it with you to right. another company. And I think Vince McMahon didn't want that to happen. So the generation after that, unless you were wrestling under your actual legal name, you would find that Vince McMahon owned the trademark and the name. So like Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect, he wrestled under Mr. Perfect in WWF, but when he went to WCW, he had to wrestle under the name Kurt Hennig.
Interesting. And
so he couldn't take it with him. And the first two big people that were big stars in WWF who went over to WCW were Diesel and Razor Ramon, real names Scott Hall and Kevin Nash.
Mm-hmm.
And they went over and wrestled under their real names in WCW, but then Vince McMahon decided to do something that was, let's say, ill-advised. And he recast Diesel and Razor Ramon with different wrestlers.
Oh, my God.
So basically, Glenn Jacobs, who would later become famous as Kane, was cast as the new Diesel. So he had to learn how to wrestle like Kevin Nash.
That's so crazy.
And they would just trot him out there. And the idea was, let's just pretend it's the same guy.
I'm guessing it wasn't very popular.
No, yes. It wasn't. It did not last long at all. And nobody wants to play a knockoff of another guy.
Right, right.
Nobody wants to watch a knockoff of another guy.
I feel that has to be for, if you're going to be a wrestler, part of the attraction to doing it is for you developing this character throughout your entire career and it being you, right?
Yeah.
It being your the creation of you and being it being your accomplishment rather than being just a 007 that gets passed along to somebody else.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing too is that you build your name in a smaller federation and then the scouts see you and they want to bring you up to a big company. And usually the Vince McMahon model for a very long time was, we're going to give you a new name and a new gimmick, and we're going to come up with a different name for your finishing maneuver, maybe even give you a whole new one. And we own all of that. We own your theme song. We own the design on your ring gear. We own of that. But I think that there's been a push in recent years where wrestlers are like, no, I want to be able to, if I get big here, but I'm largely unhappy and I want to go somewhere else for a better deal, I shouldn't have to start self-promoting myself under a totally new name all over again. And I think more and more wrestlers, like CM Punk is sort of unusual because I think he made a deal with, when he came to WWF through the brand they had, ECW, he was allowed to bring his name from the indies with him, which is a very unusual thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he was allowed to get popular with that name. And because, you know, as he got really big, he was allowed to get them to pay money to license the song Cult of Personality.
Nice. I love that song.
So that was his theme song later on. And because it's a licensed song, another wrestling federation he works for can also license it.
Right, right.
So he can keep a lot of the same branding. He's allowed to keep the name because he owns it himself. And
it's just also the weird thing because I know that CM Punk is unique because he's got like body tattoos like on one side of his body. Just to think about the idea, you've got a character name. Yes, there's a character name, but it's a person, a unique personality, a unique face, body type, and style, and movement style or whatever. The idea of trying to transpose that onto somebody else just seems foolish. Just seems ridiculous.
But I mean, sometimes they try to do this stuff. I know in WCW at one point, a new guy took over as creative and they wanted to rebrand Ric Flair as like Spartacus. And I think they wanted to buzz his hair off and make him wear a helmet or some shit. And it's like, dude, it's Ric Flair. He is as established a name in this as you can get. I don't understand why, and speaking, by the way, of somebody who has an avalanche of fucking Me Too allegations, you know, I can't have the conversation I had before about Rick Berman without mentioning this about Ric Flair.
The Ricks.
Yeah, it's a fucking plague of Ricks. These guys are a problem.
Fucking grab-ass Ricks.
Yeah, but yeah, Ric Flair, by the way, awful human being. Tremendous talent, terrible human being. That combination of things is tolerated in almost every industry, and it's sickening.
To get back to the Star Trek thing, it's the like, it really is like the J.K. Rowling Harry Potter thing, which is like post facto, you end up having the more you grow up and the more that people get removed from the creation of these things that are, you know, big cultural memes, the more you have to have like these really difficult things of being like, I love this. This is part of my being as I grew up, but there's some fucked up parts. There's some real fucked up parts.
Things that went over your head because you were six. Yeah. You know, and when you're six, things go over your head. I think I've said this before, is that nostalgia in a lot of ways is a lie we tell ourselves. That nostalgia is, on some level, the deep need to want the world to be the way it was when we were young. But the thing is, the world wasn't different when we were young. Not really. Right. We were different.
Right.
And we had a perception filter that was fogged by the fact that we were children and we didn't understand things and things went over our head. Dirty joke in a movie go over our head.
Right, right.
Political content goes over our head. Racist stuff, unless we are, you know, especially if you're white, goes over your head.
Right.
So, I mean, and also our culture changes in various ways, too. We become less tolerant of shit that we used to just grandfather in, and then you revisit it as a different older person and you go, oh shit, that's not cool. It's why I think a lot of comedies from the 2000s are largely going to go down the memory hole.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was this, again, we've talked about the aughts, there was this like aggressively anti-intellectual mean-spiritedness that came out then, and you'll just have comedies where the good guys, the lead characters, are just uttering slurs casually, and it's like, That was an awful time. And I think once we got into the mid-teens, the mid-20-teens, a lot of that stuff, we started having a conversation with ourselves and we just kind of slowly pretended that a lot of those movies didn't exist. I think there's also this historical thing that this is what, again, a lot of these angry guys you said at the restaurant or whatever were getting upset about, which is that these things are not equal. It's not like, well, my feelings getting hurt, or that's, you know, you getting harassed and screamed at and maybe even murdered is the same as me being vaguely uncomfortable at a Target. And these things are not equal. They also don't have historical difference, which is... Think of the worst slurs that you can utter. And there's some of them that have this historic power because they come from this power imbalance. That this is a word used to harass and humble and break other people, to dominate over them and harm them. And then you have words like honky. And these things are not the same thing. Because if I was called honky by someone, I would probably laugh. That word does not have power, cracker or whatever. These words do not have real power. They mostly only exist in certain kinds of 1970s cinema. And when they escape into the real world, I'm not really hurt by it. And if anyone was really honest, they wouldn't be. It doesn't have the power of the N-word or, you know, the K word, the anti-Semitic slur, or, you know, the F word, the homophobic slur. You know, these are words that have actual power by somebody who used them to coincide with a kind of institutionalized and historic violence. And that is not the same thing as I have to see a thing that makes me vaguely uncomfortable. And you know how you get over things that make you just vaguely uncomfortable? You get the fuck over them.
Right, you don't think about them
anymore. You know, that's very different. The problem is a lot of these right-wingers want to treat that kind of vague uncomfort from seeing something new that they're not used to with something that is actually a precursor to or something that happens at the same time as violence.
I felt like this is following with a sort of one of Casey Doran's precepts that I think that I've had for a long time, and it was mostly formed around the Iraq War and post 9/11 stuff, which is, I think it's just a maxim that people can never believe that what they're participating in is evil. Even people who are truly evil people will have a rationalization and a justification that to them is entirely consistent with their worlview. And evil is a pretty strong word, but to a lesser extent, people don't. I can understand that critical race theory might be threatening to people who have innate racist values and their family, members of their family were racist, and they are afraid of their kids going to school and learning about someone who's different than their family and coming back and being like, oh my God, my dad's an asshole. Like,
well, that's
Understand that. I can understand
that fear. But the other one is understanding that if your family is rich and they've got old money and that they had a certain kind of unplayed chattel slavery labor system that built that wealth, that they don't want to think about that. I mean, it's the same thing with like apartheid South Africa, which is there has to be a reckoning for things. Like you can non-violently end apartheid, which is great, but when a tiny 10% minority of white people still own 70% of the land and hoard God knows how much of the wealth in a place like South Africa, you haven't really ended the system. You really just got to go from slavery to Jim Crow.
Right, right.
You really have the same thing, which is that, you know, Prince Charles, now King Charles, can
fuck that guy,
eat that piece of shit. It would have been funnier if his fucking pedo brother had become king.
Oh my god,
let them fucking deal with that. But I'm like, how much do they have that was built on murder,
right,
and colonialism and just straight up wealth extraction from poor countries, just taking money from people, leaving them with nothing?
How much of the sort of your British society's cultural attachment and deification and protection of the idea of a royal family, how much of that is also just based on the fact of most British people don't want to think that the reason why the royal families exist and why it's so wealthy and has all these traditions is by being an empire that crushed hundreds of thousands of people?
Yeah, you can say, well, we don't do that sort of stuff anymore.
Right.
Because we can't. You don't do that sort of stuff anymore, but I already have it, and what's done is done. I'm not going to give anything
back. You don't want to say, well, I like that thing that's obviously evil.
Yeah, but yes. I mean, this is the same thing, which is there's a level of evil, too. It's like, you know, Mount Rushmore was a sacred mountain,
right,
to the Sioux Native Americans that lived there. I mean, that was a fucking sacred mountain, and we carved fucking imperial leaders' faces into the side of it. We stole it. So we stole that land that we had promised to those people forever, as if we have any fucking authority to parcel out land anyways. But white people just love to hand out land that already other people live on. We love to get to decide that stuff. We have it on paper. It's like, fuck your... But, you know, we did that, and it's not like we go, oh, well, this is a thing that, you know, white liberals too like to do, which is conservatives want to deny that bad things ever happened, that evil that built the present day ever happened. And they get angry if you bring it up. That's why they get mad about things like critical race theory and stuff.
Right,
they don't
right.
want to talk about it. But liberals want to talk about it and feel kind of performatively bad for it, but they don't want to do anything about that feeling. They don't want to give Mount Rushmore back? Well, what's done is done. You know, well, we already have it. I mean, it's not like we're killing them that way now. So, you know, if everything passed the point where we'd start overtly committing genocide and now we just let them live in the poverty that we have left them with after we've stole everything else, now everything is their fault. I mean, it's that kind of shit. Same right. thing with against South Africa or anything else, which is now that you've acknowledged this past, what are you going to do to rectify it? And it's going to probably mean having to take things away from people who have way too much.
Right.
And pay
right.
people back for, let's just call it back pay. We get all hung up on reparations, right. but it's back pay. And
that always ends up being the thing that I feel like is so insanely disingenuous about the discussion about, from a perspective of a white guy who comes from a white family who grew up in conservative Christian household, who understands the perspective of someone who would say, like, it's so evil to think about reparations, about taking money away from these working class or poor people to give it to other people just because their ancestors or whatever had this problem. And it'd be like, no, I you're right. I wouldn't want to take money away from those people. I would want to take money away from every billionaire
yeah.
and drain their bank account by 98%.
I mean, who
had, and then use that money.
So who had money, let's just say, taken away from them for over 400 years that they were not getting paid
right.
to fucking build all of that wealth? I mean, if right. anything... After the Civil War, and this is a pop culture contest, by the way, those plantations and those farms and all those crops and all that land should have been given to freed slaves.
Yeah.
Period. And that fucking asshole with his mint julep and his white suit can go fucking live in that shack out there. Fuck him. He's never contributed anything. You know, and this is what I'm talking about, which is that people don't want to have that conversation. They said, well, the overt violence is over. But you know, what's done is done. Let's just say history starts now. You can't talk about the past. I'm not myself being violent, but all of my ancestors who gave me all of the things that I have right now was built with blood and murder and exploitation and colonialism. But because I didn't kill to get it, the guy who died gave it to me, killed to get it. I get to keep it for free because we're squaresies now because I stopped whipping you. Fuck that. I mean, this is the conversation that people don't want to have. A lot of liberals don't want to have this.
What was it? Who was I talking to? It was one of my friends from who was from New Jersey. And I started off with the notion of, what do you think the people who are the children or grandchildren of sort of Italian mafioso families, what they shouldn't they be compelled to surrender their wealth? And his response was no.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, like, my family's kneecaps bought that fucking mansion. I mean, that's really what it is you're fucking criminals. You don't get to be like, well, AJ Soprano didn't do any of that stuff, but he profited from it. But I mean, again, what is this in my hand right now? This is a smartphone.
Right.
How many slaves touched this before I did?
Yeah.
How many children touched this before I did? And we have to grapple with that. How many articles of clothing am I wearing right now?
Right.
That's true. Made by somebody who had to work 16 hours a day, who might have been murdered if they tried to start a union, who may have, I don't know. I've got Coca-Cola in this Burger King cup in front of me. I know that, you know, Coca-Cola has hired death squads in Latin America to kill union leaders. I mean, I am complicit in tiny ways.
Right.
In a lot of evil. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to call it that. But I think that just because we look at the sort of like murderous labor malaise that people had to live in this country until the turn of the century, when the progressive era and I guess really the rise of a lot of leftist and communist leaders around the world forced a lot of change because people were like, wow, I better give those poor people some bread or they might kill me in my house. Which is usually, again, like in A Christmas Carol, it's the only way to get rich people to do anything, is the fear of death and expropriation. But you get these sorts of laws that you can't do this stuff in the United States anymore, at least not overtly, though a lot of states are trying to roll back child labor laws.
Yes.
The part that just gets me, though, is that even though we're trying slowly to claw back to that sort of like Upton Sinclair, the jungle kind of world.
Right.
That world still exists. All over the fucking world.
Of course it does.
In countries that we extract wealth from, that the people that wealth comes from, those countries, do not benefit or profit from, and they work essentially slave labor jobs. And that stuff powers the kind of wealth that we get, even as working class people in the first world.
Right.
And we are part of that exploitation.
This is the central evil that liberals don't really end up wanting to face.
No, you know? They don't.
Because the post facto justification is just like, well, we can, like I said, we can take this thing and do better things with this money, do better things with this stuff, but you still haven't addressed like the misery that it's created to make the wealth,
but this is always the thing that I get into in a lot of these stories where you have in a lot of our mainstream culture, you know, Disney and Marvel and all these put out these stories where the evil revolutionary villain, your killmongers and your flag smashers.
How dare you want to change the world?
But that's the thing, is that if it wasn't for their revolutionary violence, the hero wouldn't have noticed the problem.
Right, right.
And in the end, what really gets me is that we want to...
Did we talk about Black Adam on any of the shows?
I think we did.
Okay. Anyways, the same problem, which is just be like, how's Superman not realize that this country's been shit on for 20 years?
By basically a private military organization that is comprised almost entirely of white people. So
where are you, Justice League?
The Justice League didn't do shit for fucking... what is the name of the Black Adam country again? Kondok.
Kondok, yeah.
The country of Kondok has been, they say, 30 years living under this corporate military occupation, extracting this magical mineral from them and building these like Star Trek flying motorcycles and laser guns.
It is the worst of those movies.
And then when they finally get their own superhero, starts killing the fucking imperialists. Then the Justice Society shows up and says, you know what? You know, it's almost that fucking Community meme. You know what? I can live with that sort of exploitation in the third world, but what I can't stand for is a fucking murdering superhero who kills exploiters. Oh my fucking God. What do you want? We want Black Adam to hand out fucking pamphlets? What do you want him to do?
Bake sales.
Maybe if you wore like a pink Kondok hat and you sent the head of Intergang a passive aggressive sheet cake or something, or maybe came up with a dance that parodied something in a popular TV show. You know, that's the kind of, it's like, come the fuck on. That's the stuff that it drives me kind of crazy with this, honestly. And I'm dancing close to this, but it's this idea of, so, you know, people in popular culture, we love fictional revolutionaries, but we hate all the real ones. You know, John Brown is a crazy person, but we just love the fucking heroes in Star Wars. Right. Where in real life, these people would be like, oh, you know, Palpatine's not my emperor. You know, and I mean, we're going to fight even harder for more seats in the Imperial Senate. I mean, it's that kind of bullshit. It's like, come the fuck on. And it's just, and they still act as if Saw Gerrera is doing anything wrong. I mean, it's just, it blows my fucking mind.
Oh. Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Val Verde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobiah Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Every American community, you have varying shades of political opinion. One of the shadiest of these is the liberals. An outspoken group on many subjects. 10 degrees to the left of center in good times. 10 degrees to the right of center if it affects them personally. So here then is a lesson in safe logic. I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Get it?